For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, we welcome you to Indie Week. We present this weekly journal, and today this is read by John Federson, and our issue is dated February the 3rd of 2021. Selected another small ensemble for today's musical highlights. They are Nebuchadnezzar and Mabel. This is a relatively new duet who are building a name for themselves. Don't they sound wonderful? And they'll be back at the end of our broadcast. Let's get on to the aforementioned broadcast. From our straight news segment, Sarah Picanio brings us Roy Cooper and Mandy Cohen encourage schools to open their doors. Despite January being the deadliest month since the beginning of the COVID pandemic, North Carolina officials say it's safe and important to send students back to schools. Roy Cooper said in a press statement, "We know school is important for reasons beyond academic instructions. School is where students learn social skills, get reliable meals, and find their voices. Research done right here in North Carolina tells us that in-person learning is working and that students can be in classrooms safely with the right safety protocols in place." State Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen echoed Cooper's safety claims, as did North Carolina Superintendent Catherine Truitt and State Board of Education Chair Eric Davis. The group recommends that elementary school students transition to full in-person learning as much as possible, and that middle and high school students do the same, just with more social distancing. Children make up very few COVID-19 cases in the state. About 11% of last week's cases were among people under 18. Two children in North Carolina died last week from COVID complications. The data makes it seem unlikely that children contract COVID at school. Out of 90 school districts with in-person learning components and thousands of students and teachers, only 51 clusters and 1,160 of more than 71,000 cases in school-aged children and an unknown number of educators are currently traced to school systems. Additionally, caretakers worry that their children who struggle with one-size-fits-all learning, like those with learning disabilities or who live in non-English-speaking households, are falling behind their peers. Others worry that child abuse is underreported because of remote learning, since reports decreased in 2020, despite ongoing stressors. Food insecurity and mental health are also adding to the reopening discussion. Truitt said in a statement, "Learning loss resulting from COVID has the potential to be a generational hurdle, but the data we have seen shows us that schools can reopen safely if they adhere to COVID prevention policies. For many schools, the logistics of returning to in-person instruction 5 days per week will be a challenge, but this is absolutely a challenge we must face head-on so that all students have a chance to fulfill their potential." However, students aren't the only ones in school buildings. Teachers, administrators, janitors, and cafeteria workers are also confined to school buildings. The North Carolina Association of Educators says the best way to ensure schools reopen is to prioritize school staff in vaccinations. In a response to Cooper's press conference, NCAE President Tamika Walker Kelly asked the governor to make sure the state's public teachers were all vaccinated by the end of February. Currently, they are in the next group to get vaccinated, although it's not clear when they'll be able to schedule appointments. Cooper and Cohen say research supports the possibility of safely reopening without a vaccine. NCAE says social distancing enforcement is also an issue, and school systems should make their own decisions about what's best. And she said in a statement, "Particularly in light of the emerging and increasingly virulent strains of COVID, it's more critical than ever to have a flexible approach that can be adapted to whatever situation next emerges. Next, Leah Toss contributes an article about a Garner man arrested by the FBI for storming the Capitol. He was arrested on Monday for storming the Capitol on January 6th during the violent insurrection, which left five people dead. Stephen Maury Baker of Garner was charged with trespassing a restricted building and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds, according to the FBI. Baker was arrested at his Garner home without incident. According to the federal affidavit, Baker, who goes by the alias Stephen Ignoramus, live-streamed the attack on social media. The FBI received multiple tips regarding Baker in the days after the attack, and footage from his YouTube channel were widely shared. In the video, which appears to have been deleted, Baker is seen among the mob at an unspecified entrance to the Capitol. He is seen breaking into the building with others in the crowd. About a minute into the video, the stream is cut off and Baker says, "I can't go in the chamber. My stream drops." Then he appears on camera and addresses his followers. "All right, what's y'all up? What's up, y'all? How you guys doing? Super intense. Welcome. I'm Steven. I'm a live streamer and a musician. We're having fun, huh? Repeat and believe in Jesus." Although Baker was arrested in Garner, he appears to have recently lived in Washington, D.C. and worked at Middle Sea Music. A Facebook post by the business claims he was fired after they became aware of his participation in the violent raid. The post states, "Mr. Baker hid his online persona from us, and as soon as we learned of his activity, he was let go." Oddly enough, Stephen Maury Baker isn't the only Wake County musician involved in the insurrection. Another Steve Baker on Facebook, who lists his home as Raleigh, blogged that he too participated in the raid. A post on his blog, The Pragmatic Constitutionalist, describes in detail how he willingly entered the Capitol building with the violent mob that day. "At 2:31 p.m. I entered the Capitol Rotunda," the other Steve Baker writes. "By this time, the initial surge of bodies was spreading throughout the building, so it was a much thinner group in the larger hall. It looked like a normal day of tourism in the building. People were calmly milling about, taking photos and videos as of any other day, save the jubilant shouting of, 'This is our house!'" Steve Baker, who also moonlights as a David Bowie impersonator and lists vocals at Bull City Syndicate as one of his jobs on Facebook, told the Indy he attended the rally to document it. He admitted that while he's not a credentialed journalist, the videos he took during the attack have been circulated. He describes himself as a libertarian. He believes the event was organized and police allowed the riots to occur. He was adamant he did not commit any acts of violence while inside the Capitol, though says he witnessed other rioters breaking windows and kicking down doors. He said, "There was a percentage of people there that were there with ill intent, and all the other people who were there for the rally said, 'Holy crap, we can go into the building.'" When asked if he was worried he might be charged with trespassing for entering the Capitol building, Steve Baker said it's possible, given the amount of footage he's seen of himself during the riot. "Can I be charged with unlawful entry to a restricted building?" he told Indy. "Yeah, I actually think that could happen. And if it happens, I'll fight it." Jane Porter now reports on Madison Cawthorn. The newly elected 25-year-old congressman from Western North Carolina, a rising GOP star, the future of Trumpism, even Trump 2.0, has been making waves in the national media lately. Last week, The Nation documented in excruciating detail how Cawthorn misrepresented himself as a Paralympic athlete, connecting the dots between that mistruth and other lies he's told about his education and business acumen. And on Monday, the MSNBC opinion columnist Liz Plank wrote a scathing piece about how, in her view, Cawthorn uses ableist stereotypes to massage the egos of non-disabled Americans. So far, so Trumpy. Then on Wednesday, Time published a story that digs into Cawthorn's Machiavellian message strategy. Arguably, what sets him apart from the other outlandish GOP newcomers, including Georgia's Marjorie Taylor Greene and Colorado's Lauren Boebert, and even from Trump himself. Cawthorn who replaces Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez as the youngest person ever to be elected to Congress, has mastered the art of selling different talking points to different audiences, notes the Time author Abi Vasoulis. One day he's, quote, preaching about respecting the office of the presidency and vowing to work across the aisle with Democratic colleagues. The next, he's trumpeting dangerous conspiracies to right-wing crowds and commentators. The new representative from North Carolina's 11th District appears, in other words, both willing and able to engage in that old-fashioned game of politics, Vasoulis writes. And goes on, it's a skill that may paper over some of his far-flung views, earning him more airtime, more followers, and more influence than many of his Trump-supporting colleagues and predecessors, even as he continues to appeal to Trump's most hardcore fan base. As a media darling and self-styled AOC of the right, Cawthorn undoubtedly has short-term staying power, says Andrew Taylor, political science professor at NC State's School of Public and International Affairs. But unlike AOC, Cawthorn doesn't particularly seem to care about outcomes. Time reported, quote, I have built my staff around comms rather than legislation, he wrote in an email to Republican colleagues. Being fluff rather than substance has never stopped anyone from moving forward in their political careers, Taylor goes on. In the short term, I don't see him going anywhere, partly because he is such an entertaining character. He has a great story, like AOC's young, good-looking, energetic, and social media savvy. She has an established fan base. Presumably, he will get one. He will have an attentive audience. Whether Cawthorn has a long-term future, though, depends on a few things, including redistricting, the will of Democrats to stamp out Trumpism, and the fate of the Republican Party. In terms of censuring Republicans for their roles in the failed insurrection, Taylor notes that Cawthorn, unlike Taylor Greene and Boebert, doesn't currently appear to be enemy number one, despite his not inconsiderable role in inciting the mob. That's on top of the fact that the House hasn't actually expelled a member in nearly 20 years. And Taylor says it becomes a question of what does that district look like in 2022? It will be redrawn. Will there be a Republican primary challenger? I'm not sure at the moment because of Trump's hold, and I'm not sure how long the hold will be. Those are the kind of things we need to be talking about in terms of how long Madison Cawthorn will be around. While it's true that following the Capitol riots, North Carolina Republicans are leaving the party, it would be a stretch to call it a mass exodus. And Taylor says, my sense is for 2022, if he gets the Trump nod, some kind of anointing, that helps Cawthorn in any primary. But I just don't know how long the Trump shelf life is. I apologize for leaving the name of the author of this next article out of this broadcast. I did not read it from the newspaper itself, but printed it out online. Family members of inmates who died alleged negligence at Johnston County Jail. One day in mid-January, Lyric Murray, 19, wrote down the name of another inmate's mother while they both were locked up at the Johnston County Jail in Smithfield. The other inmate, Eddie Cruz, 23, was being held in a cell across from Murray's. Murray says he called his mother, Mele Brock, and gave her Cruz's mother's name. I told my mom, I think he's going to die, Murray tells the Indy. On January 19th, prison staff found Cruz, who was booked into the jail on January 13th on burglary charges, unresponsive in his cell, according to the Johnston County Sheriff Steve Bissell. Bissell says an autopsy will be performed on Cruz's body. Cruz suffered from kidney disease. Murray says he witnessed jail staff neglect Cruz for days, denying him clothes and a blanket and mat to sleep on. Cruz was on suicide watch, and ignoring him as he cried out for treatment. Murray says, quote, he started having medical problems the second day. On the third day, his body shut down and he lost the ability to walk. He would crawl to his door. The correction officers would just walk by him, as he said, the same thing every day. I need my dialysis. I feel like I'm going to die. I need to talk to my mom. The same thing over and over. Brock confirms her son's account. You'll hear my son begging to help this kid, she tells Indy, referring to a call Murray placed to her while he was in jail. You will hear the disregard in the nurse's voice. You will hear Cruz yelling in the background. They need to get the calls before they erase them. The Indy has requested recordings of Murray's phone calls from the jail. Sheriff Bizzle says he is aware of Murray's and Brock's accounts, which Brock has posted publicly. They're putting a lot of stuff out there, Bizzle says. Murray and his mama are spreading lies. Murray says on the sixth day of Cruz's incarceration, he was taken off suicide watch and given clothes and a blanket. Murray heard Cruz crying out for help again. This time it was quieter. An officer making rounds walked past Cruz's cell and saw that he was blue, Murray says. The officer called his name and then went in to the cell and touched him. More COs came and tried to resuscitate him. Murray was in tears as he watched the officers take Cruz out of his cell and onto the cell block floor at around 10 p.m. Cruz's body lay there until 2 a.m., Murray says. Bizzle defended his staff and said they will be cleared of any wrongdoing pending an ongoing investigation into the death by the Johnston County District Attorney's Office. Our deputies did everything they are supposed to do, Bizzle tells Indy. The Cruz family has been told a lot of misinformation. Cruz's mother, Maria Cruz Avila, told the Spanish-language newspaper Que Pasa that her son didn't receive medications she brought for him while he was in jail, nor did he receive the dialysis he required three times a week to manage his kidney condition. Bizzle says the jail's medical staff was aware of Cruz's condition and that medical providers saw him while he was in custody, quote, several times. He characterized Cruz's treatment while in the jail as a, quote, medical decision made by doctors, nurses, and medical technicians who are employed by Southern Health Partners, a privately owned company that the jail contracts with to provide health care to inmates. That company has not responded to a voicemail left by Indy on Friday. Cruz's death is the latest in a series of inmate deaths at Johnston County Jail over the past 2 years. In 2019, Christopher Lynn Jones, 40, died at the jail from a drug overdose, and Jeffrey Solhoff, 19, died from suicide. Bizzle told the Indy that another inmate died by suicide in 2020. A fifth man, Robert Perniciaro, was found hanging in his cell in the jail on January the 6th. He died at Wake Med 4 days later. Another inmate was found with a T-shirt wrapped around her neck in an apparent attempt at suicide on January 7th, before jail staff intervened. Abe Shewell, a Durham-based civil rights attorney and son of Durham Mayor Steve Shewell, was retained by Perniciaro's family. Says that's 5 deaths in 2 years. That's a big issue. Perniciaro, who was 26 and lived in Willow Spring, was arrested on January 4 and charged with stealing building materials from a construction site in Clayton on December 23rd. Investigators say Perniciaro and another man, Kevin Hackney, were trying to sell the materials on Facebook Marketplace. Perniciaro reportedly told his family the materials were laying next to a dumpster and didn't realize taking them would be a big deal. His sister, Brielle Perniciaro, says he didn't think it was a crime. She says her brother loved dumpster diving. He would say, look, this is so cool. I can't believe they threw this out. It was like his little treasures. She says her brother was high on heroin on the night of his arrest and would face withdrawal in jail. She says her parents, Tom and Liz Perniciaro, told arresting officers repeatedly that her brother was suicidal. She says they had an extensive conversation with him and told them all the reasons he was suicidal. They were begging the deputies. My dad, he made it very serious. She says her brother had attempted suicide in the past. She says he was worried that his past criminal record, mainly drug convictions, and the fact that he was on probation could land him in prison for a good amount of time. Shewell says when Robert was in jail in 2018, they knew he had drug issues and had experienced suicidal ideations at the jail. He confirmed that Pernichiaro's parents told the arresting detective their son was suicidal and would be withdrawing from heroin while in custody. From that point on, says Shewell, they should have treated him with a higher level of care. He says he's considering filing a Monell claim against Johnson County, alleging a pattern and practice of unconstitutional conduct based on repeated failures to supervise inmates with medical needs or suffering from drug addiction or withdrawal at the jail. Shewell says his office requested that the jail and county sheriff's office preserve Robert Pernichiaro's medical records to determine whether he was screened appropriately. Brielle Pernichiaro told the Indian, "My brother was hanging long enough to be brain dead. They revived his heartbeat at the jail and took him to Wake Med." Pernichiaro says she later learned from inmates at the jail they heard her brother going through drug withdrawal, crying and crying out for help. Bizzle says he has, quote, "no idea on that whatsoever. There was no foul play or nothing that the staff did." He says the jail staff was visibly shaken after the incident, but were able to bring Pernichiaro back before he died at the hospital. The last time family members heard from Pernichiaro was on the same day he hung himself. "He called my parents," says his sister, "on Wednesday the 6th and left a message. He asked my mom to call his lawyer because he wanted to see him that day." Pernichiaro says a Johnston County Sheriff detective also called her parents that day and told them not to bond their son out of jail because there might be more charges filed against him. She says, "After what happened that night, it was traumatizing. We could have gotten him out." Bizzle says, quote, "he does not believe Pernichiaro was under a suicide watch. I do know that the detective who interviewed him said they talked about what's going on in America, and he was really upbeat." Bizzle said when jail staff found Pernichiaro hanging, they administered CPR before transporting him to the hospital. "He did not die at the jail," Bizzle said. "I do know that the staff there at no time was at fault. They did everything they could do." Briel says she's not surprised her brother seemed upbeat. He was high the night of his arrest. "But my parents reiterated multiple times about his mental health, his past suicide attempts, and they told the officer he would be withdrawing over the next couple of days. They begged him to be put on suicide watch." She remembers her brother as, quote, "a funny, incredibly talented artist whose work was intricate, complicated, and really beautiful. He did everything," she says. "He wrote poetry. He did clay sculptures. He did carpentry. He was all into it, and he loved science. When he was a kid, he would carry snakes around. At his wake, everyone who stood and spoke said he was the nicest person. He was a good kid." Eric Cruz's family launched a GoFundMe for Cruz's mother, Maria Cruz Avila, to cover the funeral expenses. The page doesn't mention how Cruz died, but says he was disabled due to kidney disease. On the page, family members describe Cruz as a kind young man with a loving heart who would do anything for anyone. They say they will never forget his smile and his laugh. As of Sunday evening, the GoFundMe has raised $1,443. All right, Tomasi McDonald's column now. Durham council member says city residents who were formerly incarcerated should receive guaranteed incomes. Durham City Council member Mark Anthony Middleton announced plans to implement a pilot program that will give select residents a guaranteed monthly income. The pilot could include 55 formerly incarcerated residents who can gain economic traction by way of a guaranteed income of at least $500 a month until the pandemic ends and the city's economy recovers. Middleton wrote Tuesday afternoon in an email to the Indy, "After consulting with Durham community stakeholders, other American cities that have embarked on guaranteed income pilots, academic thought leaders, consultants, and city staff, we have made a determination to submit a proposal focusing on individuals that have been justice involved and are returning to their community post-incarceration. These sisters and brothers very often face dual challenges in employment and housing due to stigma. Focusing on this population will allow us to help some of our most vulnerable residents and also provide insight into the efficacy of guaranteed income initiatives on targeted populations. Middleton attended virtual meetings with officials from Mayors for a Guaranteed Income and the Stockton Demonstration Project, groups with the goal of encouraging federal legislation for a universal basic income, as well as a meeting with scholars from the University of Pennsylvania. These meetings informed the council's decision to include those recently released from incarceration. The scholars noted that, quote, 55 participants could potentially have more informational value on the efficacy of the guaranteed income initiatives rather than a randomly selected universe. Last month, Mayor Steve Shule, a member of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, announced the Bull City was among 30 cities across the country under consideration for a guaranteed basic income for some residents. Shule asked Middleton and Councilmember Pierce Freelon to lead the city's efforts to develop a guaranteed income plan. The first phase of the pilot should run for 12 months. Middleton says, I plan to continue my engagement with corporate and philanthropic partners to supplement our expected $500,000 grant in the hopes of conducting a pilot that will involve no less than 100 people. As in all things, the amount of funding will determine the breadth of our reach. Last year, before the city learned of the grant opportunity, Middleton said he proposed a trial $2 million guaranteed basic income program for Durham, quote, as part of a multifaceted comprehensive plan to address poverty, policing, and the root causes of our city's gun violence issue. The proposal was derailed, in part, due to the economic toll the pandemic has had on the city's coffers. And he said, it was gratifying to learn that what we talk about in our public square here in Durham was being noticed around the country, and Mayors for Guaranteed Income came looking for us. Although we won't get $2 million, the prospect of being able to put somebody else's money where our municipal mouth is in the midst of a pandemic is beyond fortuitous. On Thursday, the council members are expected to approve a resolution supporting the Bull City's efforts to secure funds from Jack Dorsey, Twitter's CEO, who announced in September that he had donated $15 million to Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, a group of about 30 cities. The funds could provide each city with up to $500,000. The resolution states that Durham signed on to the Mayors for Guaranteed Income pledge and is actively working with community partners. City Council members will go on record in support of a guaranteed income, and the Council, quote, supports ongoing direct cash payments throughout the campaign and until our economy recovers. Middleton announced the forthcoming resolution during the City Council's regularly scheduled Monday night meeting. He said, I'm very, very, very confident of our chances to get the money to Durham. Council members will renew the one-page resolution during Thursday's work session. The document begins with a statement focused on the impact of the pandemic that has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, along with historic job losses that have touched the lives of every American. The resolution notes that even before the pandemic, nearly 40% of American households could not afford a $400 emergency. Moreover, an already growing racial wealth gap that disproportionately impairs the quality of life for women and people of color has been dramatically exacerbated by the pandemic. The resolution notes that, quote, American cities are laboratories of democracy, and mayors across the country have allied to address these inequities and have committed to advocating in favor of cash-based guaranteed income. Resolution also notes the guaranteed payments have been more effective than unemployment benefits for families of color. And it says, the data show that another direct payment would increase Native Americans, Latinx, Hispanic, and Black family income by 4.1%, 3.9%, and 3.6%, respectively, compared to 2% of household income from white families. The resolution refutes the assertion that a guaranteed income is an incentive for hard-hit citizens not to work, quote, as demonstrated by the large number of poor people that work every day to provide for their families. Instead, the guaranteed income's underlying intent, quote, codifies a national value that declares that there exists a floor beneath which we will allow no person to fall simply by virtue of their humanity. Middleton says the council intends to submit its application for the funding within the next 2 weeks and anticipates launching that pilot by the end of next month. Now, next, we have two shorter articles written both by Jane Porter. New apartments, retail space proposed for downtown Durham along Rigsby Avenue. Durham continues to grow and gentrify. According to a report in the Triangle Business Journal this week, Hillsborough-based LLC Elmwood Development filed plans with the city of Durham earlier this month to build a five-story mixed-use project with street-level retail, penthouses, and apartments on a half-acre lot located at 318 West Corporation Street. The property, located between Rigsby Avenue and Madison Street near Full Steam Brewery and across from Surf Club, is currently home to The Pickleback, a neighborhood bar popular with longtime locals that is housed in a single-story building dating to 1962. Throughout the pandemic, the Pickleback has been home to a steady stream of outdoor cookers and guests mingling in the concrete courtyard as disco music drifts from inside the building. The bar could be replaced with 82 apartments. That's almost 7,000 square feet of penthouse space on the top floor and 2,000 square feet of street-level retail and restaurant space at the street level. The proposal is the latest in a series of upscale, vertical projects planned for downtown Durham, including the Four Points residential building plans next to Durham's Central Park, which will share space with Motorco Music Hall, and which has received much community pushback, and the American Tobacco Campus expansion with a 700,000-square-foot mixed-use space. Other proposed projects in downtown Durham include the Elizabeth Street Apartments at the corner of North Elizabeth and Liberty Streets from Charlotte-based developer Laurel Street, and the six-story Cress Condos at 162 Ramsar Street, a six-story mixed-use buildings with 20 condos, retail, and high-tech parking system from Raleigh developers White Oak Properties and City Plat. While these projects are sure to be expensive, Laurel Street is also planning two mixed-use, affordable housing projects near the Elizabeth Street Apartments project. And Jane Porter goes on with her next column, Durham Bar Owner Sues City and State for Damages Related to COVID Closure. Kevin Slater doesn't want his private club, the Atomic Fern, or any bar to be allowed to reopen right now. But he's pretty mad that neither the state nor the city of Durham has done much to offer relief to small businesses that have been forced to close and stay closed for months on end. That's why Slater is suing both the state of North Carolina and Durham city government for damages in excess of $25,000. With a Superior Court complaint filed yesterday in Durham County, Slater says he hopes to draw attention to the fact that, quote, businesses all over the place have been basically ignored. Slater's six-year-old Parrish Street Bar closed on March 16th, the day before Governor Roy Cooper issued an executive order closing bars and restaurants due to the growing COVID crisis. Restaurants, of course, have since been able to reopen at 30% capacity. Bars, technically considered private clubs if they don't sell food, were allowed to reopen with social distancing if they have outdoor seating, and any businesses can open to sell to-go cocktails, albeit with limitations. None of this has helped Slater, he says. He still has to pay rent, and even though there's currently a moratorium on evictions, one that came too late for the Atomic Fern as its landlord changed the locks earlier this month, Slater says he won't be able to afford the back rent he has accrued over the course of nearly a year, now estimated to cost him $20,000. What's really needed, Slater says, is a moratorium on rent and utilities. Quote, at the end of this, I will end up owing so much money. The small amount of relief things that they have done have not even been close to what we need. They feel like pat answers to say, look, we're doing a thing, but they're really not doing anything. Slater's lawsuit is different to the one that a group of bar and club owners filed in May, challenging Cooper's authority to shut down bars and restaurants in the first place. In that case, a judge ruled in favor of the administration, citing the governor's executive authority to close down businesses in the name of protecting the public health. While Slater concedes that his suit has a slim chance of success, he hopes it makes people and governments realize that small businesses and private clubs like his have been left stranded. He says, we don't qualify for payroll protection grants because we no longer have employees. I've been denied a business loan from the Small Business Administration. The Atomic Fern is not looking for a payout. I'm not looking for a payout. I'm not asking to reopen. We just want the state and Durham governments to recognize the efforts they are doing are not helpful. In a statement to the Indy, a spokesperson for the governor's office says the administration is abiding by scientific data to keep people safe. Quote, the governor will continue to find ways to help people and businesses struggling due to the pandemic, and he plans to work with the General Assembly to identify avenues to provide additional relief. The Indy has reached out to the city of Durham for comment. We will update this story when they respond. Sarah Pequeño checks in again. Instagram account calling out partying UNC Chapel Hill students leads to a university investigation. Where are y'all going? Every post starts this way, occasionally with more question marks tacked on the end. The locations and times change. One photo is at Little Fraternity Court during a football game day, apparent from the beer pong table and the Carolina blue polo shirt, khaki shorts uniform of almost everyone pictured. Another is on the corner of Franklin and Henderson Street, where a group stands outside in a line. The account speculates they're headed to Downtime, a local basement bar, with a party bus in the road, with its doors open and blue and purple lights twinkling through. The latest post, which was shared 2 days ago, but that has since been deleted, had more than 17,000 views and 200 comments on Friday morning. The video was a recording of another phone playing a video from Snapchat with a January 23, 2021 timestamp. The Snapchat was taken in a dark room with colorful lights where a crowd could be heard singing along to Pitbull's 2009 hit Hotel Room Service. Several faces were totally visible while more people stood in the background of the party. The packed room of maskless partiers looked like it should from a year ago, pre-pandemic, but it was allegedly just a few days old. It's unclear why the post was removed, but the indie took screenshots before it came down. The Instagram account at whereyallgoin/UNC begs a simple question. Where are y'all going in the middle of a global pandemic, after almost a year in quarantine, after UNC Chapel Hill faced fallout last autumn for their botched reopening? For some UNC students, the answer seems to be wherever we feel like, often with masks out of sight or used as chin straps, and in several apparent cases, partying like it's 1999 and not, you know, after COVID killed more than 430,000 people in the United States in the last year. The account, which first posted on August 16 of last year, now has more than 3,300 followers, with only 23 posts. The last six, including the deleted post, were shared in January of 2021. The account includes the link to report student violations to the university and a reminder that anonymous submissions are allowed. Four people in the latest post had allegedly been identified by the account, as well as the Snapchat user whose full name is visible. The Where Y'all Goin' account and other Instagram users tagged them by their handles. All of them have either changed their account name or deleted their accounts. Comments run the gamut of possible reactions. One user writes, I pity the people who have made partying so integral to their personality life that they'll risk anything, even the lives and comfort of others, for nights of temporary joy and happiness. Another, what is this account really contributing? Lots of people tag the university and its Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz official accounts. Carolina's fall semester made headlines after the university's roadmap came to a screeching halt and students were forced out of dorms and into remote learning after only 1 week. Guskiewicz says he's aware of the videos and that the university police and local authorities are working to verify the video dates and locations. Still, he says he is optimistic about the spring semester, but that people, quote, have to remain vigilant. Our UNC Chapel Hill Police Department, they're working closely with Chapel Hill and Carrboro Police to patrol in the evenings, specifically on the weekends, to try to enforce these standards, Guskiewicz told the Indy during a press conference. These are not just university standards, but as you well know, these are statewide mandates regarding gatherings, so we're working hard on it. I've been very pleased with what's happening on campus. He attributes this to the routine testing plan. Off-campus students are tested for COVID once a week, while on-campus being tested twice a week. The school has also stepped up its consequences. Guskiewicz says any students who violate the community standards could be disenrolled. The university dashboard reports that 455 COVID cases have been reported in January. The positivity rate for on-campus testing is just below 1%, which is significantly lower than the statewide average. There has only been one reported cluster since the beginning of 2021. The dashboard shows that seven people tested positive in Carmichael Residence Hall. In spite of this, Where Are Y'all Going makes it clear that students aren't just staying home, a reality corroborated by the Indy's own direct on-the-ground observations of groups of mask-free students roving Chapel Hill. The Where Y'all Going account is run by seniors at the university. The account admin says they've received various threats on Instagram. Most say they'll report them to the school, but others include sexually explicit photos or tell the admins to kill themselves. Some have threatened lawsuits. An account admin who wished to remain anonymous, citing the threats, told the Indy, "Honestly, it's not really fazing us. It should be taken seriously, but we knew what we got ourselves into." And here's Sarah Pequeno again. "No UNC Board of Governors members were involved in negotiating the 2019 Silent Sam settlement. After almost a year of Sam-less news, documents revealed today that to settle a lawsuit between the Daily Tar Heel and the UNC System Board of Governors show that the two-part $2.6 million settlements between board members and the Sons of Confederate Veterans, SCV, were made with no actual involvement from the five governors tasked with creating a retirement package for Silent Sam. The settlement revealed that four people, SCV attorney Boyd Sturgis, UNC's attorneys Ripley Rand and Tom Shanahan, and Clayton Summers, UNC Chapel Hill's Vice Chancellor of Public Affairs, were the ones behind the settlements. Jim Holmes, one of the members of the Governor's Committee to Find a Solution for Sam, initially asked Summers to participate. Summers knew Sturgis personally before they began talks, presumably from attending Wake Forest University School of Law at the same time. Summers also has ties to Republican lawmakers. He was the NC House Speaker Tim Moore's top aide from 2015 to 17. If you've forgotten all about the monument to white supremacy that protesters toppled in 2018, here's a sort of quick rundown. A few months after Silent Sam ate dirt, UNC Chapel Hill tried to allot millions of dollars to put the Confederate monument in a museum. The Board of Governors voted down the idea and appointed five members to help UNC come up with something better. In November 2019, news broke of a settlement between UNC System and the neo-Confederate SCV, which, rightfully, made a lot of people mad. In the aftermath, the five governors ostensibly involved in brokering the deal penned an op-ed in the News and Observer, where a second settlement came to light that was $1 short of requiring approval from the state attorney general, Democrat Josh Stein, which, again, rightfully, made a lot of people mad. The Daily Tar Heels parent company sued the board over the shady deals. In early 2020, the largest settlement was vacated. The other wasn't, and the SCV ended up keeping around $82,000 because of its legal expenses. The February 1st documents reveal the Board of Governors actually didn't violate any open meetings law because no member of the Board of Governors was involved in crafting the deal. Testimony reported by the Daily Tar Heel revealed the five governors who penned the op-ed didn't actually write it. UNC System Vice President for Communication Earl Whipple did, then sent it to the others to sign. The DTH lawyers argued this misled the public and made the deal look more vetted than it actually was. So the UNC system didn't technically break the law, since no public officials appear to have been involved in the settlements. Given the abject awfulness of the settlement terms, it really begs the question of why not? Probably my last article I have time for was first published at the North Carolina Health News, and it's titled "Dramatically Increased Domestic Violence Last Year." It was a call with a clear plan of action. The woman on the phone, a a member of the Halliwell-Saponi Indian tribe in northeastern North Carolina, was ready to leave her abusive partner. She needed a place to stay. So Karen Franco, a victim advocate at the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs and herself a member of the tribe, contacted a local shelter on her behalf. The shelter had room, despite crowding after outbreaks shuttered from safe homes nearby. The woman would need to test negative for the novel coronavirus before she could come, a staffer told Franco. It was May, and tests took about 2 to 3 days to process. By the time her results had come back negative, the woman had changed her mind. She told Franco she was staying with her partner. Franco said, "When you get a person who's ready to go, and then they have to have a negative test, it gives them time to turn around and go in the opposite direction of help." Reports of domestic violence spiked in the last year, confirming what advocates and providers had feared and anticipated at the start of the pandemic. Sheriff's offices across the state saw higher incidents of domestic violence, according to public records made out to each county sheriff's office. In total, these counties reported almost 2,000 additional cases in 2020 over the same period in 2019. The virus has wreaked additional havoc on victims who seek help, North Carolina researchers and providers said, by making it more difficult to access services. Domestic abuse, though for centuries regarded as a private family member or dismissed as a lover's quarrel, is considered a public health crisis, and it's a highly deadly one. In 2018, the Washington Post found that nearly half of the women murdered in the last decade were killed by a current or former intimate partner. The same year, about 40% of women who were killed in North Carolina died at the hands of a partner. People of all genders and sexualities can commit domestic violence despite the swell of coverage and conversations about this type of abuse that often centers on male perpetrators and female survivors. Data on LGBTQ domestic violence victims is often elusive and incomplete, but some studies have attempted to measure its impact over the years. Here are the findings from several reports. About 10% of men and 30% of gay men will experience intimate partner violence during their lifetime. Bisexual women are almost twice as likely to experience domestic violence than heterosexual women. Transgender women are more than twice as likely to experience sexual violence from an intimate partner than people who are cisgendered, according to a 2017 National Coalition of Anti-Violence Program report. 11% of LGBTQ domestic violence survivors in this same study reported that law enforcement was hostile after they contacted police for help. Though domestic violence can affect anyone, people of color are disproportionately at risk, in no small part due to structural racism and displacement, which can exacerbate risk factors such as poverty and trauma. In addition, a history of disparate policing and broken promises can lead people to be distrustful of government-backed support services. Nikki Locklear, Domestic Violence Program Director at the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs and a member of the Lumbee Tribe, says that's one of the big reasons why American Indians don't reach out for help. They know normally help comes from the government, law enforcement, the Department of Social Services. The same people who have historically taken our children away from us, our homes away from us, our land away from us. About 40% of black people experience domestic violence, though rates are slightly higher for black women. American women and Alaska Native women experience intimate partner violence at higher rates than any other ethnicity. A little over half will endure the experience of domestic violence in their lifetime. Beth Morocco, a professor who studies domestic violence at the Gillings School of Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill, marginalized populations, be they sexual minorities or BIPOC populations, are more vulnerable to all types of violence and often less able to access the support and the help that they need. In my research, I've seen that economic insecurity can make people more vulnerable to violence and also less able to extract themselves from a situation that might be dangerous. The pandemic has exacerbated several factors that place someone at increased risk for experiencing intimate partner violence. Domestic abuse is more likely when a potential perpetrator is unemployed, experiences isolation from other people, participates in heavy alcohol or drug use, or is depressed, all of which have increased during the past year. And the limited time I have left, I'll excerpt the rest of this article. The COVID-19 pandemic has created more barriers than usual for people seeking and providing help. Many service providers work limited hours at office, or their offices have closed entirely, meaning a person seeking help may have less opportunity to connect with an advocate. Some domestic violence shelters have had to shutter and reopen and shutter again due to outbreaks, leading to overcrowding at other shelters. Locklear said victims now are in a situation where they have to determine, is it safer for me to stay at home and face this abuse or put myself in a situation where I could possibly catch this very serious disease? As the pandemic continues into 2021, safe remote communication with victims remains a challenge. Providers said they follow the lead of the victim themselves. We're not contacting people first. We're letting the victim do the contacting. We ask them very plainly, how do you want to continue this conversation? Do you want to just call wherever you're able to, whenever you're able to? Is there a safe email address? Can I text you on this number? We take our cues from them. The pandemic has aided with one thing, research and advocates say. It's catalyzed domestic violence organizations to come up with creative ways to make rehabilitative services more accessible. And I apologize for the fact I must end this interesting article as we're running out of time and we hear Nebuchadnezzar and Mabel coming in with our closing theme. Brilliantly done, folks. This program is a podcast and can be reheard at our website all week, ncreadingservice.org, by clicking on Listen and then the Podcast tab. So, John Federson here, wishing you a good week, and hopefully we'll be back next week with our next article of Indie Week.